There we are. Okay.
Good morning, our guests, staff, and ladies and gentlemen. I'm not offending anyone, isn't it? Okay. We're starting now with the proceedings of the day today. Firstly, I would like us to be in a position to know each other. I know most of you know the members, but I want you to know them better. I'm going to request members to introduce themselves, and then from the department will do likewise and tell us who's leading the delegation. That person will inform us who is accompanying who today. Can we start at my left-hand side? Right at the corner there. Can we introduce ourselves?
Morning, Chair, Honourable Members. I am Yosimbom Raymond from the SALGA Parliamentary Office.
Honourable Secretary, I am Dapane, a member of the Honourable Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, thank you. My name is Mpuwele Swazi, a member of this committee coming from Limpopo, from the Democratic Alliance. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members of the Visitors for the Court for the ISO, member of the committee from KZN.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Anit Stein. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Kim Sampeter. I'm a researcher for the committee.
I'm Helen Matanyani. I'm the whip of the committee and the acting chairperson. Thank you.
I'm Chiri Romanenge, supporting this committee as a content advisor.
Good morning. I'm Tom Langyam, the committee secretary for this committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Sam Lefafa. I'm the chief register of the from the Department of Rural Development and Land. I'm accompanied by George Sutethi, who's head of legal advisory support, as well as Anthony Ferreira, who's an deputy in that division. We are also accompanied by Melissa Balaji. Okay. She's a part of the furniture.
Good morning. Clayton Inrix from the Department of Rural Development.
Morning, I'm Lucilo Matavati, legal advisor to the committee.
Good morning, Chair. Mo Amid Kweta from the Office of the Chief Legal Advisor.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Lombo. I'm coming from the Office of the Chief Legal Advisor.
I think we didn't hear that.
Gautam Mukhatia,
a senior researcher with the ANC caucus dealing with this kind of issue.
I'm told they are not working. Can you move to the ones that are working? I think it will be proper if when we talk we are able to understand each other and hear each other properly. But thank you anyway. We are all aware that the chairperson is off sick. Honorable Sizani, do we have any apologies?
Yes, ma'am, we've got apologies. We've got Mamu Ngonyamabila, Honorable Ngonyamabila, Honorable Kaba, Honorable Zulu, only, and Honorable Mandela. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're going to proceed, but we have a challenge, and I'm sure you're all aware that members are not serving only on this committee. So we're going to sort of have an introductory briefing, and when all the members are available, because this is committee week and they are out on other commitments, parliament commitments, we're going to request that we have a full briefing, because we thought that members will be back, but unfortunately they are still all out, and it will be unfair for us to say we have a full briefing today when they are not here and they'll be at a disadvantage. But we're going to proceed anyway and request that we get a briefing, and then the members will interact with the briefing. Who are you, the one leading the department?
Yes, but she'll present. I'm just here as the leader.
Thank you. It's over to you.
Chair and members of the portfolio committee, I would like to give you a PowerPoint presentation on the deed registry amendment bill. I think we'll start with that one. Just give you a short background on the deed registries act, and then with an explanation behind the amendment of each section. Just as a background, the Deed Registries Act 37 of 1937 is the legislation that governs the registration of deeds. In South Africa, the law does not explicitly guarantee title to land, and it's a system of deeds registration is based on a juristic foundation of long-standing practices and procedures. And it's this system that has the effect of the guaranteeing of your land title. The system's processes of examination in the deeds offices and registration and monitoring of standards and the keeping of a public register all contribute towards providing security and title in the eyes of the law, financial institutions, and the public. A deed registry regulation board is established in terms of Section 9 of the Deed Registries Act, and it has the power to make recommendations to the minister on any matter referred to in the Act and the following amendment reflects recommendations that have been made by the board to the minister. Clause 1A, B and clauses 2B of the bill provide for the amendment of section 2 and section 3.1Z. There are 10 deeds registries in the country, and the registrar of deeds in the various deeds offices are currently not legally obliged to follow the practices and procedure directives that are issued by the Chief Registrar of Deeds. We're thinking of Chief Registrar circulars, memoranda, registrar's conference resolutions. And this state of affairs results in different practices and procedures being followed in the different deeds registries, and it confuses deed examiners and conveyances in the drafting of deeds. It's proposed then that Section 2 be amended and Section 3.1Z be inserted in the Act, and this will aim to legally oblige Registrar of Deeds to follow the practice and procedure directives that are issued by the Chief Registrar of Deeds, and so to create a uniform system with regard to registration issues throughout the country. Clause 2A of the bill provides for the amendment of Section 3.1U of the Act. Section 3.1U still refers to the Register of Mining Titles, but the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, Act 28 of 2002, provided for the discontinuation of the registration of mineral rights in a deeds registry. Therefore, all references to mining titles and Register of Mining offices need to be deleted from the Act, and the amendment of Clause 3.1U is necessary in order to create legal certainty in this regard. Clause 3.1U also still refers to the Supreme Court instead of the High Court as contemplated in the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. The amendment is therefore necessary to amend that. Section 9 of the Act provides for the appointment of the members of the Deeds Registries Regulation Board. The section, however, does not provide for the appointment of alternate members to the board, and it often happens that members, for various reasons, unforeseen circumstances, cannot attend meetings. And a quorum cannot be formed, and meetings then are cancelled. It's therefore necessary that Section 9 be amended to provide for the appointment of alternate members to the board. This is also in line with Section 54 of the Sectional Titles Act that currently already provides for the appointment of alternate members to the board. Clause 4 of the bill provides for the amendment of Section 17.2 of the Act. Currently, Section 17.2 provides for the full names of a person and the person's marital status to appear in all deeds that are lodged for registration or record purposes in a deeds registry. The Act, however, does not provide for documentation such as power of attorneys, consent and application to also provide this information, and this might lead to fraudulent situations. It's therefore provided in Clause 4 that a marital status also and full names also be disclosed in all documentation, as well as deeds that are lodged in for registration purposes. Section 34 of the Act allows an owner of a piece of land to apply for a certificate of registered title of his undivided share in land. If you have a third piece, a third share in land, you can therefore apply for a registered title for your one-third share in land. However, the Act does not provide for a mechanism for an owner to provide for a fraction of his undivided share in land where such land is held and sole ownership. And the need therefore has arisen, and it's proposed that Clause 5 of the bill, Clause 5 provides for the amendment of Section 34 in this regard. Clause 6 of the bill deals with the amendment of the definitions. The definition of master still contains reference to the Supreme Court, and minister still refers to the Minister of Land Affairs. And it's therefore proposed that High Court, the definition of master be amended to to make reference to the High Court as contemplated in the Constitution, and the definition of minister be amended to refer to rural development and land reform. Clause 7 contains the short title. You'll find that's all very technical amendments. The Act only relates to registration issues. It doesn't contain any financial, social, economic. It's purely registration issues, how to register the transfer of land, the cancellation of bonds, the registration of servitudes, etc. Mr. Lefafa and Mr. Tortesi and I will gladly answer any questions that you may have pertaining to the Deeds Registry Amendment Bill, and thereafter we'll move on to the Sectional Titles Amendment Bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable members, the opportunity to interact with the presentation. I see only Honourable Steinfen.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I'm only having two questions at the moment. One is the Section 2 that's got to do with the procedures and the directives that need to be issued. I'm really very concerned about this, not with the changes to the Act, but with what is happening at the moment. We've been reading, and there was something in the newspapers again yesterday about the fraudulent activities within departments. My question would be, I don't know if it would be allowed, but what is happening at the moment? How are we securing that people know that when it's registered, it's secure, and people have gone through the right way? Is there any way that we can actually, in 10 years' time, find out that there's a problem? You say here that the only way people have security of title is through the registration and the deeds office. So is this change going to be enough to secure the security? And, you know, don't we need something else to come in place, or will you be able to say to us that you are satisfied that this is enough? Maybe it's a difficult question, but it's a pertinent one. This is the thing that people are unhappy with the title deeds and the office at the moment. And then my second question has got to do with the mineral rights. How is that registered at the moment? I'm asking the question because it's got an impact on rural development and land reform. We've heard that people are unhappy about all these mining rights, and it actually impacts on agricultural land and land use. So is there, I'm just worried. We're making these acts, but sometimes we scrap something and then there's, in any case, something else in place that duplicates that. So I'm just asking, how is it done at the moment? What happens if a mining company, where does they register their rights, and how is it kept so that we can have a list? People say they don't even know that there's mining rights on their land. So I'm asking for the land owners, how can they control that?
I wonder then if the question that I'm going to raise is sort of in line with what has been presented here. But the question that I would like to pose, Chairperson, is that currently there is, in the communal land area, there is that wording that is usually understood to be the right word, that they are in reserves. What is the portion of the registrar's office with regard to those lands regarded as reserves?
if I may proceed to say, we have in KwaZulu-Natal, in Ngonyama Trust land. In my understanding, some parts of those traditional communities have their land registered under Ngonyama, but some are not there. What is the current situation? What is happening there? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. And thank you very much for the presentation that you have done for us today. Thank you. My question is with regard to the development from this presentation. Is this amendment not going to affect the development of the land? And another question that I've got is with regard to the title deeds in and VCs, the deed of grant in the townships. Most of the people in the townships, they don't have title deeds, they've got deed of grant. So I just want maybe to be enlightened on that one, if it is possible or if it is easy for those people to convert those deed of grant to title deeds. So I just want to find out from the deeds officers whether, I don't know whether this is also part of this, but there is a serious concern coming from those people who doesn't have that. So maybe I could be clarified with regard to that. Thank you.
Can we get responses?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The first question relates to the amendment of Section 2, which gives the Chief Register authority to sort of set down the law, so to speak, throughout the country. We have 10 these registries countrywide. And the problem has always been that different offices have over the years evolved their own practices and their procedures. And to the extent that there's confusion amongst the conveyancing fraternity, as well as the people within who are charged with compliance issues. So this authority is going to give the Chief Registrar, you know, to say this is how it's going to be done and that it. And anybody who does not follow the policy or procedures set down by the Chief Register shall be guilty of misconduct. So will we be able to monitor and evaluate the quality of the deed registration system, and to from time to time seal gaps that will rear their uglies from time to time, such is the situation now that obtains within the deed registration system, where you find a number of syndicates exploiting the situation outside of the deed environment, and stealing land from municipalities such as the Sandton City, such as the city of Tshwane. just to go a little further, what is prepared by a conveyancer outside of this environment is certified by a conveyancer. The conveyancer certifies that the transferor is indeed the owner of the land and is transferring to a Mr. or Miss X, or to this particular juristic level. What is done inside of our environment is to check whether the deed registry has been, act has been complied with. So these things only come to light when the real owners of the land are alerted to the theft or the fraud of their properties. Just to give an example, in Sandton, people stole a public, what we call a public open space. You know, you can drive around and see here's a vacant piece of land, and some mischievous person conducted research to find out who the owner was and stuff like that, and they filed a lot of documents in order to effect transfer of that land. And when the Senate the municipality realized that their land had been stolen, they brought actions in the High Court to have those transfers reversed in terms of the procedures that set down in the Deeds Registers Act. So the Hawks are involved. There is a criminal investigation underway. They've already identified members of the syndicate, and they'll be pouncing on them in due course. In as far as the city of Tshwane is concerned, the very same thing happened, same modus operandi. They transferred land that belonged to the council, and the conveyancers involved certified that indeed the officials who have authority to transfer council land were the persons who signed, and that resolutions were taken by the council. All of this happened outside of the disenvironment. So this amendment is going to give the chief register of deeds, not me, Madam Chair, the incumbent of the provision, is going to give the chief register of deeds the power to, from time to time, intervene and close the gaps. Like, for instance, just to give an example, I could say in all transfers involving municipal land, the official must appear in person. You know, they're charged with that portfolio. The official must appear in person, must accompany the conveyancer to the deeds registry in order for the transfer to take place. Without that, it don't happen. Because you don't know if you find a piece of paper that is lodged within the deeds registry. You don't know whether the signatory or who has appended the signature on that particular document is indeed the person who has authority to transfer that land. So that's why the amendment is seeking to reclaim the territory from the conveyancer. So especially with a very crucial issues such as the transfer of state land or the transfer of municipal land. All right, we could all say, could all say all of that is state land, but in as far as state land is concerned, at least we have some measure of security there, because the state attorney must do the conveyancing there. And there's what we call the state land disposal of committee, which was approved. But with the municipalities, you don't have such checks and balances. So indeed, this amendment will enable, or rather empower, the chief registrar to come up with policies and procedures which will deal with the day-to-day operational issues. And I can assure you, members of the Honourable Committee, that the amendment will go a long way in addressing these issues. That is my response in as far as Section 2, the amendment to Section 2 is concerned. The other question that was posed related to mineral rights. The history of mineral rights in South Africa is a long one. At some stage, just to deal with it methodically, the state separated people, individual owners were given rights, mineral rights, and they were registered there within the deeds registry. But at a later stage, this was the position that was changed, and the registration of the mineral rights was transferred to the Department of the Mineral and Energy Affairs. In terms of the mineral and the petroleum, So there is now a register of mining titles with within the Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs. That is where the archive is held, relating to mineral titles. And we no longer have authority to register mineral rights. I think we did the amendment, effecting the transfer, when was it, 2002. And we transferred all our records over to the Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs. We don't deal with the registration of mineral rights at all, since then. Now, the other question, which was part of the main question, ma'am, was the relationship between mineral rights and surface rights, although you didn't put it that way. I'm also very worried about that, where you find people, holders of mineral rights, just encroaching upon property that is owned by a community or a private owner and saying, listen, we have a mineral right, and we are coming to prospect, for instance. That is causing a lot of unhappiness, and that is causing a lot of uncertainty, I can understand, because I'm also... people have approached me, although this is not my province, but I have been approached, you know, because they thought that because I'm chief registrar, I can intervene. No, I cannot. The Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs deals with all of these matters. And what I can say is that holders of mineral rights have got the right to encroach some land and start doing their thing there. I don't think it's right. And I don't think that is in keeping with good governance, where a property owner wakes up the following morning and there's a truck on his or her property to come and, scratch the surface in search of... minerals. So that is not my province, ma'am. It is the Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs. But I can understand the concern. they have to create some balance regarding these matters. I would have thought that the landowner must be consulted in the past when communities were involved. The minister as a trustee, the minister of land affairs, as he or she was then, used to grant consent regarding, prospecting and mining. But I don't know how they did now, because that used to help a lot, because a formal submission had to be addressed to the minister of land affairs. For permission to allow the prospecting or the mining of rights on their communal land. But like I say, the Department of Mineral and Energy Affairs have to deal with those issues. And I think in as far as trust land, what we used to call a trust land, which has not yet been transferred to communities, I think that process still has to be followed. The other thing is where chiefs or traditional leaders have an area of responsibility. I think it's only fair that they should also be consulted. The mining charter, I'll stick out my neck and say the mining charter, I think, prescribes that chiefs must be consulted, and they must grant the prospecting and the mining of sites in those areas their blessing. So that's what I know, and it's also not within my province. Although I said I agree, it is a bit unfair. Okay. And then there's other question dealing with reserves. What is the position of reserves outside of Ingwenyama Trust? this is a very interesting matter because just before Uhuru, that is 1994, millions of land were transferred to the Ingonyama Trust. That is, this land is situated in the KwaZulu-Natal province. And the very act, the Ingonyama Trust Act, deals with all of these matters relating to that land. But the question, if I understood you well, my honorable member, is what is the position about land that falls outside of the Ingonyama Trust, the so-called reserves? Well, we have legislation within the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform in terms of which these rights could be upgraded. That is, the right in land in those reserves could be upgraded. We have, for instance, EPILRA, which EPILRA is the Informal Protection of Land Rights Act, one, which can protect informal rights in those reserves. It is an interim measure that is, protects rights within those reserves, and it is an act that protects vulnerable, you know, holders of land rights within those reserves. Now, we also have the upgrading of Land Rights Act. Yeah, we also have that. In terms of the legislation, communities or vulnerable people with uncertain land rights can approach the Department of Land Affairs and make a request that their rights be upgraded. It has happened. There are examples within the department where these rights were upgraded, and these people moved from the position of being reserved, and they became land rights holders. So there are procedures, there are remedies. The only thing that should happen is, honorable member, people must approach the local and land reform office. For instance, the land reform office is in Pietermaritzburg, I think, where people could approach the officials there and make application for their rights to be upgraded. There are procedures that have been set out, and surely the rights in those reserves can be upgraded. Now, we have another question here that deals with title deeds deed of grant. As far as the title deeds and the position is concerned regarding title deeds and deed of grant, these could also be upgraded, the deed of a grant. The deed of grant can be upgraded to title deeds by mere endorsement. By this I mean these deeds of grant can be lodged at the deeds office and they can be upgraded to full title deeds. There is no problem at all. These could be upgraded. And a deed of grant is just as good as a title deed. Only that has to happen is that it must be officially upgraded. Yes. Yeah. The other question was relating to whether or not the amendments are going to affect development, if I understood the question well. The answer is a definite no. what is sought to be achieved through these amendments is just to regularize certain issues. Regarding uncertainties within the diesel environment. Development will go forge ahead undisturbed. It will never be affected. Of course, honorable members, the development is dealt with through other pieces of legislation. We are the foot soldiers, so to speak, within the diesel environment. We are right at the end of the whole process. All that we're charged with is to see to it that the issues of compliance are dealt with properly. If a piece of legislation that deals with development prescribes certain issues, then we'll see to it that those are complied with. And we have no right, nor do we aspire, to control issues of development. We only become involved when the procedures are set out have to be to be complied with as compliance officers within the diesel environment. I think that was the last question, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask a follow-up on my first question regarding the safety of people, that people know that they are secure of their title if they went through the process and registration. The reason why I'm asking is there's one thing that I couldn't understand from the beginning, and maybe your department is the correct one to answer. We are dealing with these land claims issues in this department. So if we have a system of registration of title deeds, why is there so many disputes on the land claims issue? Is it because maybe, you know, these title deeds weren't registered? When did this start? Maybe the question is, when did this registration of title deeds start? How well is it preserved and kept? It's the one thing that I couldn't understand, you know, if you have your registration of title deeds and there's a claim on the land, it's not so easy. You go and you get title, you see what, you know. So it's one question that I've been trying to suffer with, and my question links to at the moment. Are we not going to get the same process again in 20 years? People are going to dispute. I dispute the fact that, you know, I've registered this piece of land, now there's a claim on my land. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. So I'm trying to find out how secure is this. If we have this, is it not then easy to solve the land claims issue?
Ma'am, honourable member, this is also very interesting. The question of land claims only arose, if you remember well, just after the new dispensation and then the Restitution Act came into place in 1994. The Restitution Act, as you will remember, deals with which claims are valid and how should they be pursued and enforced. Now, it is a characteristic of land claims that a historical research must be conducted as to how the land was acquired. That is the history of acquisition. That's what they use, the phrase that they use, the history of the acquisition, the price that was paid, you know, and all of those other provisions. But like in any other sphere of human activity, you will find people who want to take chances. People who say we're removed from land X, Y, Z, and historically we owned that piece of land, or my ancestors owned that piece of land. So the commission must just do its work. and investigate these claims. And we have the records. We have an archive. We have a deep archive. We can go back as many years as we possibly can, up to the 17th century, which is 1652. We have those records, and if there's a chance taker who claims that they own the land, that chance taker will be exposed. That chance taker will be exposed. Because if we don't have the history of the acquisition of the land confirming the claim, then they're on very shaky ground. Just for example, the other day I dealt with an inquiry emanating from the office of the commissioner for Northwest. Was it Northwest? Yeah, I think it was Northwest. In which some landowners, current landowners, were saying they can only settle. They can only sell the land for 807 million rand. And she said to me, Sam, can you go back a little and tell me for how much that land was acquired, when it was acquired? And we discovered that in 1965, the land was bought for 800,000 rand. So this current owner of this land converted the 800,000 into millions. And the evidence is there, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, that the land was acquired for 800,000 rand, not millions. So it shows you that our records can at least help. So I want to say further, Honorable Members, in as far as land claims are concerned, the position of claimants who are not backed up by our archives is very shaky. Those claimants will be skating on thin ice. Because if you say you own the land, then the in our archives, there must be proof that you indeed this particular individual or this group of individuals own the land, or this particular community own the land. So if it's not there, then it's difficult. That is why, there's always tension between the landowners and the Land Claims Commission. It's specifically because of issues around the ownership. The landowner saying, but you're saying you are removed, but there's no proof that you ever owned the land in the past. So my question is, my answer is in conclusion, honorable members, we have solid records as far back as the 17th century, and they cannot be corrupted.
I'm not sure about the last part. The information cannot be corrupted.
Honorable Swade and Honorable Kalakul.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. When I was actually asking that question of deed of grant and title deed, I forgot to actually include the PTO. So I just want to know the status of the permission to occupy, because that is actually used by the people who are living or staying in the rural areas, and some of them are actually need to be upgraded. I just want to find out if that is also possible. And also with regard to the alternate members of that you actually referred to, that actually some of the meetings were not cooperating because some of the people were not actually being able to attend. So the minister is now given with this bill will be empowered to record
or put in record the names of the alternate. So I just want to find out how many alternate is the chapter, is the minister going to be given to forward, so that when they have that meeting, those people are there, because it only says a member could give names of the alternate. So I just want to find out, and then so that we can know exactly how many people will be needed, their names to be recorded. Thank you.
Again, this is a question of intrinsic. As an explanation was given with regards to the mining companies having the right of prospecting in the areas, what comes to my mind is, if then, in the case of a communal land where people have establish themselves as residents in the area, then here comes the company with that right to say, I have a right of minerals under the surface. You are only having the surface right of trading in the area. In those rural areas, because it's fairly understood, maybe in the case of cities and towns, it's quite impossible that a mining company can demand to prospect and mine under those development or development well developed areas. In case of rural areas, but when people are fairly well developed, maybe what would be the way out for those mining companies? Do they still carry the right to say they would want to prospect and mine in those areas? If the minerals are of maybe a profitable sort of future for them to mine, I think.
Can I ask another question? Are you able to tell us how much land is owned by the state in the former homelands? And the other one, if a person wants to develop communal land in the rural areas, especially in the former homelands, what is the process? That person, process pertaining to the transfer of land for that business? Thank you. The process pertaining to transfer of land for business processes in communal land, in the homeland.
Within the Municipal Structures Act, whether I think there is tension there. You know, traditional authorities are still refusing to become part of the municipality because they are unable to sit there, to have one seat, I think, in the council. But they want to become independent. As of the last time that I dealt with this issue, you still had to apply via the Ministry of Land Affairs. Anybody can apply for business within those communal areas. That is no problem. Now, the other question, honourable members, that was asked is the one that relates to the extent of land owned by the state in rural areas. That's a difficult question. We're busy with an audit, which we will complete at the end of this month. That will inform us how much land is being owned by the state. I'll tell you why it was difficult to come up with an answer just like that. In the past, before the new dispensation came into place, state land was owned by different entities, you know, the different provinces. We used to have four provinces in South Africa, Free State, Transvaal, and all of those. we still have some of the land that is still owned by those institutions, but we are busy cleaning up our data. Like I said, we'll complete hopefully by the end of this month or mid-August. We had things like the Republic of South Africa, the Union of South Africa, the INI from South Africa, the Republic from South Africa, you know, all of those things. So, Botswana, Transkei, Eastern Cape, and stuff like that. The exercise that the Chief Surveyor General is involved with is to clean up that data and to be able, so as to be able to say, this is what is owned by the state. I would be misleading you if I proffered an answer at the stage. So if I could be granted an indulgence to provide you with that answer, say safely by the end of August. And if I can access the information before then, so will I table it. But the project is far advanced. then there was a question relating to PTOs. PTOs are rights in land. All right, within the formalized structure of deeds registration, they may not be right, you know, in as far as the holders are concerned, but these are going to be upgraded. These are going to be upgraded into full title, because this system of PTOs, permission to occupy, has been in place, I don't know, since time immemorial. I think it was proclamation of 1969. The proclamation of 1969. What, R188? Yeah, R188 of 1969. That came up with the PTOs. So a child that was born in 1969 would be 41. So PTOs have been there for many years, and it would be foolhardy for government not to recognize the PTOs. I mean, there are some developments that I know of that were done on the basis of PTOs. That's how strong a PTO was those years. The vast tracts of land that are being commercially exploited on the strength of PTOs. So these are going to be upgraded. Now, the other question that was asked related to the alternate members of the deregulation board. I didn't quite understand it, but in my attempt to understand it, I thought it was information was being sought as to how the amendment is going to ensure that the deregulation board functions properly.
I actually wanted to know, because it says the names, so I actually don't know how many people are actually constituting that board. So that's why I was asking from the perspective that how many names will be actually given as an alternate into the board.
Now I understand. Look, in terms of current legislation, there are how many members, George? You can take it.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Currently, the board, the chief registrar is the chairperson. Then we've got two members from the Law Society and a departmental representative. So there are four. So for this amendment proposes that for each and every one of the other ones, that is not the chairperson, that is the departmental official and the representatives from the Law Society, there must be an alternate member. So there'll be one for each member. So there'll be the alternates will be three, two from the Law Society and one from the department. Thank you.
Just to complement his answer, we find ourselves in a difficult position where sometimes official members of the deregulation board are not able to attend for one reason or the other, or they are sick. I mean, being sick can happen to any one of us. Now, when this happens, we find ourselves at sea. We don't know what to do. We have to postpone our meetings, and we only meet once a year. And that it could be very dangerous because every year we try to improve our environment. So the purpose of the amendment is to make sure that even in the event of permanent members of the board being absent, we have people who can operate in the absence. Alternate. That is all that was taken to do.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on that point, it says the minister must in the same manner in which the member of the board is appointed. Can we just understand how is the members of the board appointed at this stage? Are they being that section?
What happens is there are nominations from the Law Society, and there are also nominations from the department. Usually the DG nominates. The Director General nominates the departmental official to serve on the board. And the Law Society nominates members of the Law Society that have to be to serve on the board. Well, there are various issues, like Antoinette is saying, you know, it must be representative and stuff like that. The chairperson has got the right to co-opt members of certain institutions, you know, into the board. You know, like members of the Sarafian Property Association, what do you call it, for SAPOA? The architectural profession, it depends. We do it in that way. if you have the opinion that they could advise. And they don't have they make inputs.
I wish that we wrap by 5:30 so that we take the second presentation. Can I give Honorable Swate and Honorable Stay? Oh, okay. It's only on. It's kind of cool. Getting old, don't worry about it.
Thank you. Mine is just a quick one regarding the process of actually changing those PTOs and the deed of grant to title deed. Who's going to lead that process? Is it going to be coming from the people actually asking for a department to change it, or is it going to be department actually changing it on behalf of the people? So I just want to know, because that process actually is a difficult one, and people there, they don't know exactly what to do, but they are in mass. In the rural area, they are in mass. In the townships, are so many, those who got a deed of grant. So how are we, how is that process going to be actually be put forward so that people could understand? And how is the people going to get that information? Thank you.
My candid advice, honorable members, would be for the people to initiate the process. Because if we are going to wait for government to come one day to do it, look, the will is there, the political will is there. But there are many challenges, as now that we have another mandate, rural development. I think it would be better if this was initiated by the communities. But what I can do, I can go back and discuss this matter with my counterpart, that is the official who's in charge of land reform, and inform him that this matter arose, during the briefing, and there's a concern around issues related to upgrading of deeds, not only deeds of grant, but also PDOs and stuff like that. And I would stick out my neck, although it's not my territory, and say to him, I think go out and develop a communication strategy so that the people could be informed. When next I appear before the committee, I'll report accordingly and tell you what I've done in that regard.
Chair, I was just to request if maybe I did not hear the explanation in regards to the residents in the rural areas of the communal land versus their rights versus the rights of the miners wanting to mine. I just if I can touch on.
Should I? Yes. Those a mind twister, honorable member. I wouldn't know a better venture now. Yes, I agree. In rural areas, it's very easy for those mineral rights to be exploited. But I think it will be very difficult to exploit those mineral rights in the well-developed areas. Because I do not think it would be justifiable for a whole development to be destroyed in order to pursue profits. Devon, for instance, or Cape Town would not be destroyed in order to pursue mineral rights, which would only benefit a particular sector. I don't think that would be possible. But then, well, of course, you find things like deep mining, but deep mining, I don't think happens easily. unless the profits are very huge, and the confirmation from the EIA is conducted, the environmental impact study is conducted, that it would not disestablish what has been in place for so many years. That's my humble response. I'm not an expert in that field.
Thank you very much. Can you proceed to the next briefing?
Again, just to give you a background on the Sexual Titles Act. Titles Act 95 of 1986 is legislation that governs building developments where multiple owners hold a type of property ownership known as sectional title units. Sectional title scheme is made up of sections and common property. Sections, we think of apartments, flats, townhouses, and then owners also have a shared ownership and shared areas known as common property. Here we think of parks, elevators, parking areas, etc. And a section, together with your undivided share in the ownership, common property, is then known as a unit. The Sectional Titles Regulation Board has made the following recommendations for the amendment of the Act. Clauses 1A, B, and C provide for amendment of definition of developer, minister, and owner. Clause 1O, A provides for a developer's agent or successor entitled to act on behalf of a developer in respect of the approval of development schemes. Currently, agent is allowed to act with regard to the transfer of units, but not development schemes. That's why the proposed amendment is made. The clause 1B provides for the amendment of the definition of minister, again to refer to the Minister of Rural Development and Land Reform. Clause 1C of the bill provides for the deletion of reference to repealed Agricultural Credit Act and the definition of owner. Clause 1D of the bill proposes amendment of Section 13A of the Act to provide for bodies corporate to approach the court in instances where it is unable to obtain a unanimous resolution, just to open the door for bodies corporate in this regard. Clause 2 of the bill deals with the boundaries between a section and another section, or a section and common property. Section 4 refers to a median line of a dividing floor, wall, or ceiling as a boundary. And you do find that windows and doors are built into the into walls, and it's just an amendment is proposed to make it clear that the median line in such an instance will go through the center of such a wall or door. Clause 3A deals with the amendment of Section 11 of the Act. A sectional title register can currently be opened on more than one piece of land. It may happen that one of these pieces of land are a mortgage with a mortgage bond. And in this instance, the provisions of Section 45 of the Deeds Registry fines application. But confusion are currently experienced with regard to the format of the application and consent to the cancellation or substitution of such bonds. That is why the proposed amendment of Section 11.3D is proposed in Clause 3A of the bill. Section 11 and 12 of the Act provides for the issuing of one certificate of real right of extension of a scheme and one certificate of exclusive use area as reserved by the developer in terms of Section 25 and 27 of the Act. And the issuing of only one certificate creates problems in circumstances where such rights are subdivided. And it's proposed in Clause 3A, B, and 4 of the bill that the provision be made for the issuing of more than one certificate in that regard. Section 7 deals with the cancellation of a registered sectional plan. Section 14 only provides for cancellation of a plan by order of a court. However, such plans can also be cancelled without an order of a court when buildings are damaged or with the destruction of a sectional title scheme. Amendment is therefore necessary just to make it clear that a court order is not necessary when upon a destruction or damage of a building. Section 15B, the same amendment as in the Deeds Registries Act, does not cater for the certificate of registered title in respect of a fraction of an undivided share in a unit. It's therefore proposed that the bill provide for an amendment to provide for a sole owner to apply for a fraction of an undivided share in a unit to be issued a certificate of registered sectional title in that regard. Clause 7 provides for the amendment of Section 24. Section 24 requires the consent of every mortgagee, a bondholder, where there's an extension of a section and that extension results in a deviation of more than 10% in the participation quota of a section. Conveyances are not, the Act provides for a conveyancer to make such a certificate, but conveyances are not qualified to make to determine such a deviation, and the Act is therefore proposed that the Act be amended for such a certificate to be issued by a land surveyor or an architect. Clause 7 of the Bill proposes that amendment. Clause 8 provides various amendments to Section 25. Section 25 currently only provides for an extension of the scheme by the addition of sections such as flat and exclusive use areas, annex garages. The section doesn't provide for the extension of a scheme only by the extension of exclusive use areas only. And various problems are being experienced by developers in this regard, and it's therefore proposed that the Act be amended to provide for the extension of a scheme by the development of exclusive use areas only. Clauses A, B, D, H, 2M proposes this amendment. Section 25 also does not have a mechanism to extend the period of time in which a right of extension must be exercised by a developer. If such right is expired, the right currently falls upon the body corporate. So it's therefore proposed that in Clause 8B that such an extension be granted upon agreement between the developer and the body corporate. Clause 8B and C provide for the amendment of Section 25 for the reservation of an extension in respect of a building or building that already exists. Currently, you can only make an extension with regard to a horizontal or vertical extension of an existing building or the building of new buildings, but not for in respect of buildings that already exist. Clause 8F and 9D, Section 25.4A and 27.6 refer to urban immovable property, and it's necessary that the word urban be deleted in order to bring the provisions with regard to the granting of mortgage bonds within the permit of the national, within the ambit of the National Credit Act. Section Clause 8F and 9D proposes this amendment. Clauses 9A and B proposes an amendment of Section 27 of the Act. It makes the registration of exclusive use areas as depicted on a sectional plan compulsory. It's currently possible for sectional plans to only be registered partially with regard to the part of, which contains the sections only and not the exclusive use areas. Amendment is therefore necessary to force the developer to register the whole sectional plan and also then to seize the exclusive use areas within a period of 12 months. Clause 9A provides that for that amendment. Amendment of Section 27.4, as proposed in Clause 9B of the Act, provides for the vesting of exclusive use areas in the body corporate free from any mortgage bond or registered lease or registered real right in such exclusive use area. Clause 10 provides for the amendment of Section 29.3. Insofar, currently the section provides that the consent of every bondholder, mortgagee, must be obtained with the registration of a servitude over common property. Mortgage bonds are registered on a daily basis and also cancelled on a daily basis, and it's virtually impossible for conveyancers to obtain such consents. It's therefore proposed that the Act be amended to provide for such consent to be obtained on the execution of the notarial deed relating to the registration of such servitude. Clauses 8A and 8E and 11A provide for the amendment of Section 37. Section 37 does not oblige a developer to pay costs, levies in respect of areas of common properties that are subject to future developments. It's therefore proposed that the section be amended to force a developer to pay such costs towards insurances, rates and taxes, water, electricity and maintenance of such land. Clauses 11B and C provides for the amendment of Section 37(2) and gives clarity with regard to the payment of contributions in cases where ownership of units have changed. Section 37 also does not provide for the levying of of special contributions. An amendment is proposed in Clause 11C, and it merely confirms and legalises a situation that has existed for a considerable number of years. Clauses 12 and 13. Clause 12 of the bill provides for the amendment of Section 44 to include the regulation of the use of exclusive use areas shown on sectional plans. Currently, only the use of sections, if it's for businesses or residential purposes, are shown on sectional plans. And it is proposed that the use of exclusive use areas also be shown on sectional plans. Clause 13 of the bill proposes the amendment of Section 54(2) of the Act still refers to the Association of Law Societies of the Republic of South Africa. And just to change the name to the Law Society of South Africa. Section 60A and 60 still contain provisions that relate to the old 1971 Act, and propose that these sections be amended just to bring it in view of the new provisions of the current 1968 or 86 Act. Clause 16 just contains the short title of the bill.
Thank you. Yes. Members. Honourable Dean.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll start with the two easiest ones. Questions. The first one is just for clarification. This clause 6, section 15B, that deals with a fraction of the undivided share of a unit. I'm not exactly sure how it works and what does it mean. If you can just explain to me exactly, you know, what is meant by that. And it maybe will link to my third question, which I will ask last. My second question would be, is the special levies that's charged. What mechanism has the what body corporate have if they don't agree with it? The decision is now made, and they and so what mechanism is there? Is there something in the Act that provides for that or not? And then my last question is, and you will see from our first round of questions, we have a lot of questions regarding the communal land and titles and use of the, because we had a presentation last week by the committees, by members. When I read through this, it kind of made sense to me that we can put people in communal land on this sectional titles system. If you give people ownership of the piece of land that they live on, and the rest of the land where the cattle or whatever is can be used as what was it called, this common property or common, how easy will that be to transfer communal land in this way? And one of the discussions we had earlier was that it wasn't surveyed, this pieces of land, and I had this question when I looked at my first question regarding this, what's it called, this pieces of land, or what if I can't remember the correct word, linked to my first question. So how easy will that be to actually transfer land under the sectional title, or won't it work at all? Thank you. Can we get responses? Thank you. With regard to your question on section 15B, we have the same amendment also in the Deeds Registries Act. Currently, the legislation provides for when you have more than one owner of a piece of land, and then if you and I, for instance, have a piece of land, I can go and obtain a certificate of registered title for my own share in that land, and I can then go and mortgage my land, and I can go and sell it, my whole share in land. The Sectional Title Act does not provide for the issuing of such certificates where a person holds that own land on its own, and therefore there has been a need for owners to obtain certificates of registered title for fractions of their own in their own piece of land. For instance, where you have a townhouse in Clifton and you want to obtain a title deed for every month of the year, you can obtain certificate of registered title for 1/12. So you have 12 titles, and you can then dispose of those titles or mortgage them or transfer them. So that is basically it.
The position that the amendment seeks to rectify is that people with undivided shares had to act together to dispose of the land, I mean of their property, the section or whatever. But now the amendment is making it possible for say people are six, for the sixth member to say, okay, I'm disposing of I want my title prospecting in respect of my sixth share of the townhouse in Clifton. You use Clifton, eh? I want the title, a certificate of registered title, to be issued in respect of that share. Currently, that is not possible. And the amendment seeks to rectify the position. So that where you find six people owning property in undivided shares, each one of them must be issued with a certificate of a registered title. And they can do as they please with their share.
Thank you, Ted. Coming to the next question relating to special levies. That is about the mechanics. Presently, the Act does not provide for any special levies. So the industry itself has been having a practice of charging special levies. So at the advice of the industry, we were advised to amend the Act to take into account all the existing practices that they are already engaging on. So this the amendments that are proposing the special levies are introducing a concept that is not there in legislation, but there in practice. So this is to formalize and legalize what they are already doing on the ground. Now coming to the whole notion of sectional titles in communal areas, sectional titles, by their very nature, they are linked to a building. So if there's no building, then there can be no sectional titles. So in the communal areas, if they want to make use of sectional titles, firstly, they'll have to get the land on which the sectional titles will be built, surveyed, because for you to get sectional titles, you need to have a building, you need to have sectional plans, You need to have a lot of surveying taking place. So for the people in the communal areas,
if they would want to use sectional titles for their living arrangement, it's possible. But if then they maybe they want to use it for any other thing else other than living in one building and owning it in common ownership, it won't be a good idea for them to or consider the issue of sectional titles. Thank you, sir.
Honorable Swati.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think somehow we need to be clarified. Because here it is actually saying that initially there was one certificate that was actually issued now. All those other people who are actually collectively owning that section, they also need to have their own title deed. So I'm not sure as to whether the title deed that actually was, that certificate that was issued first, was it for the land or was it for the building? So, and the sectional title deed that's going to be provided to them, is it only for the homes in those houses or what was that? I actually want to be clarified in that regard because I can't get it very clear. Thank you.
The Act actually already currently provides where land is held by more than one person for all of those persons to obtain certificates of registered sectional titles for their deeds. Just to clarify to you the position with regard to the rooms in the building, or if you take, for instance, a block of flats and you buy a flat in that block of flats, that flat is your section. And then you have a right over common areas such as the garden, the elevators, the staircase, the parks outside. That is your share in the common property. That's how sectional title scheme works. What the Act now tries to do is to give an owner where you by yourself owe a section in a building to for you yourself to obtain a certificate of registered sectional titles for fractions of your ownership in that unit. So it's not where lots of people own it. The Act already provides for that. So it's for you as a sole owner to take out certificates of registered sectional titles. I think this whole thinking behind this proposal came in with timeshare. People that want to sell weeks of the year or months of the year. And therefore, in order to sell a week of the year of your flat, you need a title deed to do that. And that was the whole idea behind the amendment of the section.
Thank you, Jefferson. Maybe for clarification, the way that I understand that section is you've got these holiday schemes or whatever, where you are a owner of a flat or an apartment, but you rent that or sell that for certain weeks of the year to different people. So this it will cover that kind of situation.
As far as I know, that will cover that situation definitely. Because when you're an owner then of that specific week, your contributions towards the levy will also be worked out according to the fraction of your ownership. You will pay levies according to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, what would be the unintended implications be again? Because if you subdivide, it's basically subdividing and subdividing and subdividing, won't that be actually giving more problems? I'm just thinking of if we write something like that in an Act, what would be unintended negativities coming out of something like that, and if it's not covered in your rules at this stage, what was the reasoning behind putting something like this in the Act? I'm trying to understand that because you know it's something that changes hands a lot. These kinds of weeks that people buy. That's my first one, and then my second one. I don't think my question wasn't so clear. If we write into the Act now that the special levy is completely off, I'm also on unintended problems.
what will happen if people do not agree with the special levy? Because now it's going to take, you know, back to court again if the board, or it's not the board, it's the the trustees that can bring the special levy. Are we not going to make another problem again by writing it into the act? I'm just trying to understand what the reasoning was behind this. If it's not fined, if it's defined in a property association's agreement or something.
Okay, the topics that you are touching now all relate to the managing of essential title schemes, the rules. Again, if there's many owners and many owners of the unit, and also with the changing of the special levies, if all the owners agree with that, all these issues will have to be put in the rules that are applicable to the sectional title scheme. Currently, Section 35 of the Act provides for a registrar of deeds shall not get involved in the enforcement of rules that are applicable to the sectional title schemes. And we have therefore also the Department of Human Settlements are currently drafting the Sectional Title Schemes Management Bill that will deal with all the rules. And all those rules, issues pertaining to the rules, will be deleted from the Sectional Titles Act, because we currently don't have the knowledge to deal with issues pertaining to rules. We only deal with the registration and surveying issues. But my guess will be those matters will definitely be have to be included in the rules. How you're going to solve them?
Sorry for that. Coming to the issue of the special levies, that is, what will happen if people do not agree to paying those. Currently, there's Section 41 of the Act, which deals with issues when members of a body corporate are not paying their dues to the body corporate. So that Section 41 will also deal with those issues of non-payment of the special levy. So we don't foresee any unintended consequences.
Just to go back, Madam Chair, to the question, I think, which is still disturbing all the members of the state, about the issuing of the certificate of registered title. Look, like Antoinette correctly explained, you can do that, and you can have a certificate of registered title issued in terms of the Deregistration Act. What we are doing is just to accommodate this within sectional schemes, where we say, we say there are 50 people within that particular scheme. You can apply for a 50th, isn't it, George? 50th of and say, I want my certificate of registered sectional title in respect of my 50th chair. Currently, it's not happening. Especially with regards to undivided chairs, relating to the common property and the section.
Just to add on that, Chair, I'll give an analogy of a loaf of bread. A loaf of bread being a section in a scheme. You've got title in respect of that loaf of bread. But now we're wanting a situation whereby you can slice the loaf of bread so into small slices. Then you get title in respect of the small slices. The whole loaf of bread is still yours, but now you're owning it in smaller pieces. That's the whole notion behind the thing.
I think the members are satisfied. In that case, we would like to thank you very much. And
the members are requested to remain behind to deal with further business of the committee. And you can be excused. Thank you very much.